Alrighty. So, I have on your notes, it says week 7. Of course, this is week 1 of part 2, but it's really week 7 of 12 weeks on Aquinas. So, that's why it says that, if you're wondering. But, the subject today is truth, knowledge, and speech. So, essentially, you're looking at Aquinas' epistemology and his theory of language at the same time. And if Christian philosophy could be called objectivist, which I sometimes use that word, sometimes to get into the skin of people who call themselves objectivists, but then other times I think it might be a sense of flattery. They might self-flatter, I suppose, as they hear my words, and that is the opposite of my point. But if we could use this word of Christian epistemology, and I think Thomas Aquinas best shows the way, at least in the Middle Ages. And if you're looking for a theologian or a thinker who's on the opposite end of the spectrum, that's really famous, I think the 20th century you would look at someone like Karl Barth, and on the question of whether or not God can be known or how he can be known. But just as one example, I think how this works, the difference between the way we think and the way they thought back then. According to Aquinas, a thing is knowable to the degree that it's actual. So when somebody like Aquinas would think about, is this thing knowable, he didn't define knowability down to the person making the discovery, the discoverer, but he defined it up to the thing being discovered. So in the Summa Theologica he said, since everything is knowable according as it is actual, God, who is pure act, without any admixture of potentiality, is in himself supremely knowable. But, he continues, so he's going to factor in the thing that we usually bring up. What is supremely knowable in itself may not be knowable to a particular intellect on account of the excess of the intelligible object above the intellect. As, for example, the sun, which is supremely visible, cannot be seen by the bat by reason of its excess of light. I can't tell you how many times in the first couple of years in ministry, we, for some reason, got a lot more college-age kids in those earlier years, about almost 10 years ago now. And I can't tell you how many 18 to 22-year-olds I had to spend detoxing, like I was bringing them out of a cult. But what if we don't see? Then that's bad. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar. But what if I don't see that this is here? Then you're wrong, and you'll stub your toe. What kind of a question is that? But I started to get used to it, and I realized that's where we're coming out of. We literally don't believe in the superior thing. And Aquinas says that the sun is supremely visible. But bats exist. I know that. But the sun is supreme. But we do the opposite. So hopefully we should start to get the sense that the medieval Christian defined a defect in a thing by its distance from the greatest thing. In other words, the medieval Christian defined a defect or something going wrong in comparison to the thing that was right. The defect in light of the perfect. Whereas we tend to lash out against the excellent, defining defect in the inability of a thing and to see something, and then as it turns out what we mean is that there's a defect in the sun. The sun is defective because I can't see it, and we're unwittingly projecting our inability on the greater object. Well, this is completely the opposite to the way Christians used to think, and I think Aquinas, this is really the value of him. So we're going to break this into two sections today. First of all, what I'm going to call Thomistic epistemology, and then secondly, Thomistic linguistics. And the big idea to everything today is that Thomas's theory of knowledge and language, in that we can discover a Christian objectivism. In Thomas's theory of knowledge and language, we can discover a Christian objectivism. Little disclaimer here, so that the objectivists self-proclaimed today, who are not objective at all, don't puff up. Let me be clear that we are not modifying the term Christian by the term objective. And what might be even less clear, we are not even modifying the term objective by the term Christian. On the contrary, we are claiming, with a little bit of help from Aquinas, that only Christian philosophy is properly objective. Only Christian philosophy can rightly be called objective. So, let's get to Thomas's epistemology. Let's define a couple of terms first. The first word I want to define here, let's put over here, is the word intelligibles. The word that he used, basically to mean the proper object of thought. And if you're thinking of the word intelligible, when does something become intelligible to me? That's right, you're right on, that's where that word comes from. But he's going to use it as a noun, an intelligible. This is the proper object of the intellect. What is an intelligible? It is any proper object of the intellect. Such an object would be anything that can rightly be called a substance, a particular thing, and therefore anything for which there can be a science that studies it. Now, it's not the form of things as they are in matter that makes something intelligible, but Aquinas would say it is precisely an immaterial form which is the object. So pick a thing, anything. It could be anything you think of. Notice about that thing that the thing's total nature, or at least its sufficient nature, is the same as its intelligible nature. Even when you're looking at something physical and you say, I don't see where to all that. Even when you say that and you mean something physical that starts to come to sight, if we were to ask you, what do you mean by that? You would be talking about a series of things that are totally immaterial. And by immaterial, I don't mean not to do with the subject. I mean not physical, transphysical, in other words, supernatural. So, the sufficient nature of a thing. In other words, enough about that thing is what we mean by intelligible. Now, the sufficient nature of a thing is always an immaterial form and not the extent to which the form has its matter. Everything we mean by a substance, remember a substance in Aquinas is any particular thing. All that we mean by a substance is entirely an immaterial object of thought which transcends the ever-shifting material composition. So that's very important. So by intelligible, it's going to be a circle. This is going to be the object of thought. Everything that this is, its sufficient nature, is an immaterial object of thought. The sum, the parts, everything we mean, each part is a sum, and each of it is an immaterial object of thought. Okay, so this thing here is, this over here is going to be my mind. Okay? That is an immaterial object of thought right there. So that's the first thing we have to get down. So what distinguishes the intelligible from the sensible? Well, and by the way, this is what's going to, this act of doing this, of separating or distinguishing between the intelligible and the sensible. So think of the word abstract. The sensible, in other words, that material composition that operates on my senses, sensory knowledge. This action here that we sometimes call abstraction, abstracting from particular things, physical phenomenon, to the actual answer to the question, what is that? And I can't just do that or pick it up and, right? You're actually looking at it and saying it's a, and you're always meaning something immaterial. That action of abstracting is what separates man from animal. So it separates a rational being from a non-rational being. So what does that? What distinguishes the intelligible from the sensible? Well, now we're going to get back to this whole debate about realism. Following Aristotle against Plato, Aquinas would say that it is not the ideas existing as separate things. On the other hand, the universal ideas are also not merely mental constructs, so against conceptualism. These ideas that makes this object what it is not merely a mental construct, nor is it merely a useful name against nominalism. So remember, Aquinas was a realist, but he was what, I hate this word, he was a moderate realist. We're going to see even that creates difficulties. But this idea is an objective thing, but there has to be at least two things. So this is the second level that we're going to add into the equation. On top of this thing that he's calling it intelligible, there has to be two things that exist. In other words, he's asking the questions. Okay, there's knowledge in the world. We have to assume that. We know things. The question is, what necessary conditions have to exist to explain this? So this is our brute fact. And the question is, what has to exist to explain this? Well, two things. One, there has to be what he calls an active intellect. And remember that word, act. How there has to be a supreme act to set anything in motion. an active intellect. And the second thing you need is what he calls an agent intellect. And this, by the way, is going to mark the distinction between the divine and the human intellect, but I'll show you what he means. So, there has to be an active intellect activated by no other. In addition to that, there has to be an agent intellect that is the human reason, that draws that objective circle of meaning around the particular, that particular thing that is being at that moment intellectually colonized. I use a concept of C.S. Lewis there in his book on miracles. He talks about that reason can colonize. He's doing what Adam did. God brought the animals to them, and whatever he named them, there's an objective knowing. There's a circle of meaning. And that entire activity is an immaterial activity about an immaterial thing. And so we can say things like this. This book is useful. That's in your notes. I broke it down to its four parts, grammatically, logically, in terms of the proposition. There's four parts to it. In our logic class, all the way down to kindergarten, the basic parts of a categorical statement are studied, and this is how you would break that out. This book is useful. This is the existential quantifier. That's what we call it in modern logic. The book is the subject. Useful is the predicate, and that little connector word is what we call a copula. That's the word is. Now, notice about those four things that they are things that transcend the material, molecules, and motion. So what does the agent intellect do when he says that? The agent intellect, that's the human reasoner, abstracts from the sensibles, or even those particular things which are not sensory. But at no point in this sentence or any other are we speaking of molecules in motion as such. But instead, there's a, look at that chart there, there's a this-ness, a bookness, an is-ness, and a usefulness. If I was to ask you what any of those four things are, you could not point to those ink blots and say, that. You would mean something that exists beyond that particular thing. If you took away this book, those four things would still exist beyond that particular. And even when you just use those words, molecules in motion, even if you want to talk about that. Each component of that object, a water molecule, for example, in motion. Each component of that object must itself transcend the merely material. And consequently, these intelligibles, these objects of thought, must be the substance in act which moves the effect in finite reason. So let's build that chart that we had back in week two. Remember, potential, actual, and we use the example of a piece of lumber and a table. But in this case, I'm not going to have a piece of lumber and table. I'm going to have a knower, let's call it a mind, and I'm going to give him more knowledge, whatever it is. And I'm going to draw it as a bigger circle just to make the point that I have more knowledge in this mind than I had before. So let's put in this right circle, knowledge. If all of this follows, then you need a third thing, a substance in act, in order to make this that is potential raise itself to actuality. Okay? And so this substance in act is the intelligible, the object of thought. How do I know more? Well, I know more about what? Something or nothing? Something? And if it's something, then that something is going to be the cause of that increase in knowledge. So, what is right reason, but reason about that which is? And what is that which is, but that which exists, above and beyond the agreement of the human mind with it? So when my human mind agrees with what is real, what is causing that? Answer, what is real? The thing that is real is acting upon my mind. One of the things that you'll see, you'll be amazed how many Christian books will dabble into this, but this rejection of knowledge as the mind, or sorry, as the world pressing in on your mind, reality making an imprint on your mind, that's old thinking, that's objective thinking, that's Western thinking. That's the world imposing itself on my mind. But we now know, as good postmoderns, that our minds are a bit like cameras in the nightly news, and we point it whichever way we will. We're already wrapped up in a story. We already have biases, and our minds are the actors, and we're determining reality. That's not true. That's subjective thinking. That's me at the center thinking. That's me thinking that I'm God. This view has reality pressing in on me, making an imprint on me, so that my knowledge is actually what's being colonized here. Gilson, that Thomistic scholar that we've mentioned a couple times, provides three guiding assumptions of Aquinas that form the backdrop of how we know things. So now we're just going to cement home this very same idea with just some different ways of saying it. So Gilson gives us three guiding assumptions. Number one, he says, in its humblest aspect, the human intellect appears to be a passive power. So read the word passive to be potential. Let's put over here in this circle, passive, or in parentheses, potential. I have potential knowledge, so that I have maybe the rules of logic. Maybe I know my ABCs by this point. And so when I come across the works of Shakespeare, the potential, namely the ABCs, can be activated by that object. Okay? So Gilson gives us point number one. In its humblest aspect, the human intellect appears to be a passive or potential power. Second point, an intellect is said to be in potency or in act according to its relationship with universal being. So think of, remember what a universal is, and then remember that God is that being that has all these eternal things in himself. So a mind is either passive or active. Whenever we say that, we always say it in its relationship to universal being. We're going to see that it's universals that start to press themselves, that we mean, by all the things that we mean about an object, we mean a universal. So it's entirely and only universals that are activating, that are making for knowledge. Otherwise, we're just animals running into particulars. We're just by instinct coming up to another particular thing, but we never grow in knowledge because knowledge is always about things, and things are always of universals. Third point that he takes from that, intellectual passivity is then a natural correlative of limitation of being. So we're being in this state of potentiality, which God is not, but all human knowers are. All finite knowers are in a passive and potential state. Intellectual passivity, then, is natural to being a limited mind. So I have to remind myself, intellectual passivity is perfectly natural. We've got to whip that into shape, of course, with God's truth, but it's natural. Well, this follows from Thomas's metaphysics, as we've already described. So if you remember that scrap of lumber and that piece of table, but you needed that third thing, namely that saw, that's the substance in act. And you saw how that started to set up all of his five arguments for God's existence. Well, it's also going to set up his theory of knowledge. For anything whose essence is not to be, remember, only in God is his essence to be, to exist. But for anything whose essence is not to be, it follows that its potentiality cannot raise itself to act except by some substance already in act. That's what we see in that chart on the right. Now, the proper end of the intellect is that which is intelligible to it, such that the objects of intellect are the cause of all intellectual activities. Now, he's going to bring in the end cause. We have a natural end. What is the natural end of the nature of beings like us? It is to know these objects of the mind. Now, only an intellect in a state of pure actuality has more than this passive knowledge. That is, knowledge which is only potential and not actual. There has to be a being who is completely active in intellect. There's nothing to activate. There's nothing passive or dormant. He sees it all. He knows it all. And obviously, he's talking about an omniscient mind, namely God. So what does he do? He breaks down passive intellects into two kinds, the angelic kind and the human kind. Let's just put this over here. And he's not going to dabble into his theory of angels yet. He's going to get to that. But he's only trying to show us two kinds of passive intellects. Now remember, it might help you. Passive comes from the Latin word passio, which means to suffer. Okay? So if I am passive, that means I can suffer, and that just means change or be affected from outside of myself. Okay? So classical theologians talked about the impassibility of God, that God cannot suffer change or be affected from outside of himself. And modern theology absolutely rejects that because they misunderstand what's being said. But at any rate, two kinds of passive intellects, angelic and human. Here's how they have to be introduced. And this is Gilson again summarizing Aquinas' view. He says, there is indeed a kind of potentiality in which potency is never deprived of its act. This is to be found in the matter of celestial bodies. So he's picturing planets in their orbit. They're passive. They have to be activated. But they seem to be in a constant rotation, in a constant revolution. There's also a kind of potentiality in which potency is sometimes deprived of its act and must pass into act in order to possess it, such as the matter with corruptible beings. We see at once the angelic intellect is characterized by the first of these two grades of potency, which we've just defined. Its proximity, this is why, so he's making an analogy between planets and their orbits and angels orbiting God. It's this kind of intellect, its proximity to the first intellect, to pure act, makes it always possess the intelligible species in act. The human intellect, however, last in the order of intellects, and as far removed as possible from the divine intellect, is in potency to intelligibles, not only in the sense that it is passive in relation to them when receiving them, but also in the sense that it is naturally deprived of them. So let me summarize this even more concisely by calling one of these kinds of intellectual passivity constant and the other dormant. So this is the passive. Both need to be activated. Both need to learn new things, but the angels are not deprived of anything that is natural to that pursuit. Human beings, and all you have to do is teach one of our classes, particularly to the teenagers, are constantly deprived of that which they need to pursue this, like caring, for one thing. Okay? We'll come back to the angelic beings later. His only point to bringing them in is to draw out this dimension of intellectual potency and act on a spectrum. Now, a lot of other stuff that is interesting, but I think I really want to focus on these three things that you need here. In all of this, we can see that Aquinas believed that all real knowledge is mediate. So one of the things that he would say, I'm gonna have to make a new board. So erase this, hopefully got it. All knowledge, all revelation, therefore all truth is mediate. And this is going to start to create the controversy between Aquinas' way of thinking and a lot of modern perspectivalists and even presuppositionalists. Mediate. Mediate revelation. Why? Because it's theory of knowledge. I have to back up a little bit here and see that you need three things. We've already seen that you need an active intellect. So let's just put God up here. We've already seen that you need an agent intellect. So let's put man down here. But you need a third thing. You need a divine act of revelation. So let's put in parentheses by God, act. Remember? Nothing that is potential can raise itself to actuality except by some substance already in act. You need an act of revelation. But you need the human reason summoned to action. So let's put by man, action. And in this case, it is an intellectual activity. But you also need a medium of secondary causes that form the object of revelation. Now here's the thing. If you're going to disagree with this, that this can be the object of revelation, I would say my main argument against the presuppositionalists at this point is that you can't have it both ways. You can't, on the one hand, deny that we can know the essence of God. We have to know Him by His energies or by His works. But then cut out that. You can't say, we can't know God directly. We have to know Him by His effects. And then cut out His effects. Okay? You can't have it both ways. And so this formed a huge part of the debate between Sproul and Bonson, for example, and the debate between Gordon Clark and Cornelius Van Til. And all the other debates about that from there on out. But there's a denial that the way God is known is through a medium or a media. In other words, in the things that have been made, Romans 1:20. Or in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God and all the different parts of creation spoken about in that way. But that medium, that forms the object of revelation, and that forms the objects of the intellect. In other words, the intelligibles. This is the cardinal point of contention between the classical definition of natural theology and both, on the one hand, and both the evidentialist and presuppositionalist schools of the modern church on the other hand. Evidentialism, so this Thomistic theory of knowledge is going to go against both evidentialism and presuppositionalism. That's another mistake you hear. Aquinas and classical apologetics is the same thing as evidentialism. Wrong, 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 wrong. You should not be teaching at seminaries. Evidentialism starts with a common reason and argues to revelation. The assumption is that there's something outside of revelation, that common ground. Presuppositionalists are right to criticize that. Presuppositionalism reacts against that and makes revelation immediate only, not mediate. It is not mediate. It is only immediate. God is speaking directly to us, and if He's not, that's not truth. Well, there's a truth in that, but there's also a lie in that. And what it does is it cuts out any usefulness in the mediate objects of the intellect. But the classical approach of Aquinas includes all three necessary ingredients. The act of God revealing, the objects of revelation and reason, namely the medium, and the reasoning itself called into action. Now, Gilson goes as far to say, and this is an interesting idea, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it's an idea called assimilation. And he actually talked about, well, let's go do it over here, that the human knower actually, in a sense, becomes the thing, or let's just say it charitably, that part of the thing that he's looking at. Now, there's a truth in that. If what they mean is sort of a 1 John 3:2, that we shall be like him because we will see him as he is. In other words, we become more like the thing that we're looking at. Because of the supreme form of existence is to be. And if we're becoming, we're looking at. So that's an interesting idea. I think Gilson accurately summarizes what Aquinas is saying there, that idea of assimilation. But it's actually too interesting to get into because we don't have time. So that's extra. Ask me afterwards. I'll be happy to talk about it. But here's the upshot. What then is truth? What is Aquinas' definition of truth, given all that? Well, first, here's one thing it's not. He says it is not identical to being without distinction. Now, he's not denying what Augustine held, that being equals goodness equals truth, that Christ is truth, that Christ is God, and therefore God is truth. He's not denying that. He's just saying, for the purpose of language, we can't say that being is truth per se without distinction, because we mean something by truth. Okay? Truth is a dimension of it that is distinct from it. Okay? Otherwise, he says, it would be superfluous to say true being, which it's not. And he offers an argument for this. He says, and it's basically a syllogism, you have it on your notes there, if you couldn't distinguish them, then you'd run into this problem. Since good and being convert, in other words, since they're convertible, since they're equal, if being were identical to true, well then good and true would also convert. And that's the same form as the syllogism, or the famous one, A equals B, and B equals C, therefore A must also equal C. If it were true that they were completely equivalent, then good must also be completely equivalent to true. But, he says, many things are true which are bad. Now, he's not going to deny that it being true is good in some higher sense. He's not even going there. So if you're just to anticipate that objection. So he says, true and good do not convert without remainder. Okay? And he offers a couple of examples. It is true, this is my example, that a robbery happened yesterday. Okay? The truth in itself, in God's mind, is good. But the robbery is not, and that's what was. So they're not identical with no distinction. So what's the distinction? Well, it's this. That what is true is not equal to what is in creatures. There's the distinction. The creature is not, in a perfect sense, as we've already demonstrated when we talked about existence. Only God perfectly is. All else comes to be. All else passes out of existence. Nevertheless, we speak about each of these things as being true. And yet we do not mean that they have the same being as being itself. So then he launches into this discussion of, well, there's three ways you can mean truth. And he quotes Augustine and Anselm, and then the third way is a little bit trickier. Let's see if I can summarize this. First, I'll just quote him directly. In one way, according to that which precedes the notion of truth, and is that in which the truth is grounded. Okay, that's kind of Augustine's idea. Truth equaling being. He's saying that's one way you can mean truth. I'm not disagreeing with that. Secondly, in another way, truth is defined according to that in which the notion of true is formally perfected. That's the way Anselm talked about it. Remember, rectitude of our mind to God's mind. That's that correspondence theory of truth. And he agrees with that too. He says, in a third way, truth is defined according to an effect consequent on it. Okay, so best way to shorthand this is as follows. One, you can mean truth as correspondence to being. You can mean truth as correspondence of my mind to being, in other words. Or you can mean truth as consequential, logical implication. Okay, so he's saying that they're all valid. Okay, we just have to make this distinction. And that's going to be important for his view of realism. Because if you get back to realism for a moment, you see that truth, in Aquinas' view, is not in things but in the intellect, and you're immediately like, wait a minute, he just took back objective truth. Truth, here's, now my circle is the mind. I'm looking at an object. Let's do it, the tree, because that's the picture over there. Truth is not in the object, but in the mind. Now, did he just say that that tree is whatever this mind makes it? No. He's saying that the word truth is the correspondence of this to that. So, Edwards' definition, when he said, truth is the agreement of my mind with the mind of God. Something like that. Okay? So when he said agreement, he didn't mean that you can make, or only if I agree with God. That's not what he meant. He meant just correspondence. Or, the word truth is what I mean in here about what is out here. So it is an objective view. Okay, he's just making that distinction. So, if somebody was to look at this and object that, wait a minute, that's not objective realism. But it's important to remember that what makes the nature of each thing a true nature remains in the mind of God. So a moderate realist, forget about Aristotle for a second. Aquinas can use those same words that Aristotle did, and what he means when he says that truth, when he denies Plato's kind of realism, that the ideas are the forms, every individual idea or form is an idea in heaven. They're separate things, as if they're outside of the mind. He said, no, they still have to be in a mind. But don't forget, there's a mind in which even things like trees exist. Okay? So, if universals are inside the mind, namely in God's mind, then they're still outside of our mind. Okay? It's just that when you use the word truth, you mean my mind's correspondence to the way it is. So, for example, a rock is not true or false, strictly speaking, but a rock is or is not. Now, if a rock is falling, then it is true that a rock is falling. So we don't call a rock true, we call a rock real, and then we state a truth about the rock. Okay? Now this is like, man, this is a hair-splitting distinction. But it's important, So you can see how his kind of realism is not in any sense compromising objective truth. It's actually a better defense of it if you state it correctly. So that's his view of epistemology. I'm going to get to his linguistics in a second. Any question at all on his epistemology, his theory of knowledge or truth? All right. By the way, that's one clue that the professors that you are paying money to should not be getting your money or anybody else's, is when they label theories of truth and they sort of survey all the different views of truth that have been held and they call them theories, and one theory is the correspondence theory of truth. That's just one of, you know, 31 flavors. There's truth as encounter. There's truth, and they lay all these out and it's like, so which of those or all of them correspond to the way reality is? Okay? The correspondence theory of truth is not a theory at all. It's the only thing you can possibly mean by truth and not be in the asylum. We're just in the big asylum. Okay? In which the lunatics are running the asylum.
My experience of seminary and people we've taught is that they want to talk about connective tissues.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they don't want to talk about bones.
Right.
Bone structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference of what you're trying to give us, bone structure and then building to connective tissue.
Yeah. Yeah, and on the one hand, they want to give you their real theory of the way it is without admitting that they're doing so. And then 99% of what they do is deconstruction of bone structures and tissues and everything else. So it's like 99% deconstruction, but then couched in this language that this is the way it is. Nobody is apparently able to say, wait a minute, 99% of what you said totally invalidates this 1%. Why should I pay you right now? Why should I sit here right now? What is your authority here? And they have none.
That's part of my
experience
with PTSD. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe this ties into what Tony was saying. Can you define a little more the word medium?
Mm-hmm. Yes. By medium and mediate, we simply mean a secondary cause or a means by which you come into contact with the thing itself. So let's make a distinction between the thing itself versus the vehicle or the avenue which you come through it. So let's just take Psalm 19:1 and let's just apply it most generally to the stars. So by the radiance of the stars, I see the radiance of God. By the comparatively continuity of the sun, Edwards' argument, the eternal burning of the sun, we know it's not eternal, we know, we got the second law of thermodynamics, we got that, but again, it's only a medium. It's an analogy. The sun is an analogy of Christ's excellence and his passion and his glory. And so the medium is the sun there. That's the intelligible. And the things I'm seeing are intelligible precisely because of the medium. And literally, it's where we get the words media and so on from. Now, you're going to see a synergy between Thomas's theory of knowledge and his linguistics. And he gets all this stuff on his theory of language from Aristotle's book on interpretation. And it's been called the triadic theory of signification. Meaning, three things, three ways in which you can signify something. And remember, in speech, there's a sign, there's a signer, and there's the thing signified. And these are going to be three ways to do that. And the whole question begins in epistemology. The question is, how do we know? How do we know that our words actually correspond to the actual meaning of things? And if we could put a finer point in the question, say it a little bit theologically, we could say it this way. How do we predicate of things in general? In other words, how do we ascribe meaning and predication to things, and of God in particular? And especially, how do we do that if God is simple, as Thomas just got done saying? If God is simple, one thing, not many things, and we say God is love, God is justice. Well, that's two things. That's three things, because God is one, love is another, goodness is another. But Aquinas said that he's simple. How do you predicate things of God? Well, the response of Aquinas borrows from this triad theory of Aristotle, and it goes like this. Our speech about things has to be at least, or has to be one of these things. Our speech could be univocal, so vaca, call, una, one. It could be equivocal, or as he's going to land on, analogical. Now, what are all three of these? Let's say we take two things and we say, that thing is tall, and we say that thing is tall. Do we mean about those two things one thing, or two things, or nothing? Well, if we take any two things and we use a word, univocal would mean that they are absolutely identical. When I ascribe goodness to that thing, I mean the exact same thing as I mean in another thing. If it's equivocal, there's no relationship at all. Totally opposite of the spectrum. It's an identical relationship here. There's no relationship between the two things over here. If you want to be consistent, that means that my word's about one thing. My word about the thing bears no relation to the actual nature of that thing. Now, where do you think a nominalist would fall? An equivocal speech. And so, naturally, the criticism of realism is that it demands univocal speech. Now, Aquinas was not guilty of it, but another guy, John Scotus Duns, later on was. The Reformers learned their realism through Duns and criticized Aquinas and scholastic thought on that basis. That is the origin of the debate between presuppositionalists and classicalists. And at that point, Sproul is right, and he's a lone ranger on that point, and a lot of other Reformed are wrong. But at any rate, I mean modern. The original Reformers and Puritans were realists. Okay, even somebody as late as W.G.T. Shedd was a realist. So we'll come back to that. So Aquinas is looking at this and he's saying, well, if they're identical relationship, that's a problem. You lose the creator-creation distinction, and that's Van Til's point. But on the other hand, if it's equivocal, then there's no relationship, and there's where Barth is, that there's no God, it's wholly other. You can't say God is good, I'm good, or God is and I am. You can't say that, that God is wholly other. Well, what can you say about God then? Nothing. What's that? Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't, meaningfully. So analogical is that one predicate to any two subjects have a significant relationship. What does the word significant come from? Sign. Ah. What's a sign? Is the stop sign me stopping? No. It tells me to stop. It points beyond itself. It is not the same thing that it's talking about, but it is like it. There's a significant relationship between the sign and the thing signified. Okay? And it's pretty obvious when you break it down like that. Oh, option three. Right? Otherwise, all of our speech would be, who would disagree with that? Most people. Most people opt for one or two. And most people today would opt for two. Now, it should be immediately clear what is at stake in this choice. Now, if our speech was univocal, again, take this up to theology, then the statement that God is just and that my cause is just would demand the exact same essence of justice in both cases. It's like justice would be like a pizza pie broken up between my just act and God's nature. On the other hand, if the relationship between human speech and reality was equivocal, then we could not ever know what is just and what is unjust. Nor could the idea have any meaning to begin with. And so saving the day is the principle of analogy. Analogy is likeness. It is not exactness. That's identity. Analogy is likeness. R.C. Sproul, in his book, The Consequences of Ideas, talking about Aquinas' theory, summarized it like this. Quote, with analogical language, the meaning of a term changes proportionally when two different beings are described. So there's a principle of proportionality. So that here's a circle. This circle, let's pretend it's more circular than the other circle. But this is called a circle in proportion to this. And so if it's a bigger thing, you say, well, you can't call that a circle compared to this circle. Now, that's exactly why I can call it a circle, because I'm comparing it to that circle. You couldn't say you can't call this a circle compared to that circle if you did not compare the circles. And you could not have compared the circles unless you already had the idea of circularity. Okay? Now, here's the deal. Whether you're talking about one thing that is the effect of the other, or whether you're talking about two things that are completely alike, their likeness is based entirely on some third thing by which they are likened to each other. There's a proportion. Now, two things, one theological, one philosophical. Two bases for this idea. Bases, whatever. Is there a plural? Who cares? Anyway, here's the theological one first. The doctrine of analogical speech rests back on the biblical doctrine of man as the image of God. If you believe in the doctrine of the image of God, you should have no problem believing in this theory of analogical speech. Why? Well, because Thomas spoke of an analogy of being, whereby we are like God in one sense, even as we are not like Him in another. Wait a minute, it sounds a lot like Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our image and in our likeness? Likeness. It is very difficult to understand how this doctrine and its linguistic entailment can possibly be assaulted by Bible-believing Christians. But so it is. The presuppositionalist K. Scott Oliphant chronicles in his book Reasons for Faith how the early reformer, Peter Vermigli, began to write against the idea of the analogia entis, the analogy of being, on the grounds of divine infinity and divine simplicity. Since we are not like God in that sense, well, where'd you get the idea then? Adding that guys like Francis Turretin, and I'm going to have to investigate this, I still haven't read Turretin firsthand, but he says Turretin also started to come down on the same path against Aquinas' idea of the analogy of being. I have a hard time believing that. Because he wrote a big systematic theology, and that's not always a good sign, but he was reformed. He was Italian. He went to Geneva. And that's like three really good things. I mean, so I don't understand. I don't believe I'm going to have to investigate that, because I'm not sure I believe that. But anyway, that's what Oliphant said in that book. But the most famous and devastating assault on Thomas's doctrine from within the Christian community was made by Karl Barth in the 20th century, the idea that God must be wholly other. But theologically, this idea rests back on the doctrine of the image of God. Now, philosophically, logically, the doctrine of analogical speech also rests back in a little Platonism that Aquinas held on to. It is not the case that Aquinas was purely an Aristotelian with no aspect of Platonism. In the Summa Theologica, Part 1, Question 15, on ideas, and that's on ideas in God, Thomas asks the question whether there are ideas in God, whether they are one whether there are many or one only. That's a typo. Whether there are many or one only. And whether there are ideas of all things known by God. This is the most significant break from Aristotle toward Plato in the thought of Thomas Aquinas. He deliberately equates the Greek ideon, which is where we get the word idea, to the Latin forma. So Aquinas approvingly quotes Augustine on this point, and therefore agrees with Plato at least on this point, that ideas or forms are in the mind of God. So he quotes Augustine, quote, "Ideas are certain principal forms, or permanent and immutable types of things, justice, redness, beauty, oneness, they themselves not being formed. Thus they are eternal, and existing always in the same manner as being contained in the divine intelligence," end quote. So if anybody says, these historians of philosophy, that he's a moderate realist, not an extreme realist, and by extreme realist I mean somebody that believes in this idea of forms, exactly the way that we've laid out realism, biblical realism, in these classes for years, that these are either attributes of God or ideas in the mind of God, that is word for word what Augustine and Aquinas both said and agreed to. So, how does this all relate to analogical speech? Here's how. It is simply that every instance, in other words, every example of a thing down here, say a just act or a red rose, every instance of an idea must be related to its form as an effect is to its cause. This thing that is like this thing, the thing that we say is like the other thing is the smaller thing, the more consequential thing, the effect. The other thing is the more prior, the antecedent thing, the cause. If I say that this, so in other words, for example, this is very relevant, it is appropriate to say that man is like God, but it is not appropriate to say that God is like man. Not because there's no likeness between them, but because it has to flow in one direction. from the form or the essence to the example. A true analogy of something else must always actually owe its existence to the thing that it is like. And if the two things are equal, again, on the bottom, then the two of this pair must likewise be made like to each other by something more ideal in that same genus, as two healthy brothers are of the same health in virtue of health per se. Now let me make a final assessment on the debate over natural theology and knowledge that has gone on in the modern church. There's first of all a debate between those who say that we can know God's essence and those who say that we can only know God's energies or works. Thomas, interestingly, cites 1 John 3:2 about the beatific vision to show that this cannot be so. We must know God's essence in some way. In other words, that He is in principle knowable. Now, in our day, Michael Horton has added his name to the list of those who deny the knowledge of the essence of God. In his book, The Christian Faith, published in 2011, Horton agrees with Aquinas' principle of analogy, but is reluctant to affirm the analogy of being. But in question 12 of the Summa, which is devoted to showing the absurdities of supposing that we can know God's energies without knowing His essence. First of all, how do you know they're His energies and not some other God? But here Thomas employs a very interesting argument. He says, quote, "For there resides in every man a natural desire to know the cause of any effect which he sees, and thence arises wonder in men. But if the intellect of the rational creature could not reach so far as to the first cause of things, this natural desire would remain void." In other words, he's saying, just like you do in end causes, if you cut out the ultimate cause, you cut out the whole series of subordinate causes. They would never have arisen. So, I arranged an argument here, which I think is a faithful representation of his argument. It's longer than a simple syllogism. In fact, there's six premises and a conclusion. But let me just read them to you. They're in your notes. First of all, he's saying all human beings by nature seek the cause of things. He's assuming that. He hopes you do too. Of course, you might say, no, I don't. But he would probably say, then you're the kind of person that Ayn Rand talks about that seeks things by whim, but without an explanation. Now, Rand can't justify what whim is, but that's another story altogether for another day. So he starts there, all human beings by nature seek the cause of things. Secondly, to seek the cause of a thing is an end. Seeking anything is an end. That's what we mean by it. The end of seeking a cause is either subordinate or ultimate. There's only two kinds of end causes. Either it's subordinate to some greater end, or it's the ultimate end, right? So pretty clear so far. Fourthly, no subordinate end can arise apart from a more ultimate end. Now, why do we know that? Well, the next premise, and it draws back in his question 2, article 3, the arguments for God's existence. No infinite regress of more ultimate end causes is possible. That was the fifth argument. It is not possible to have an infinite regress of causes, whether first cause or end cause. He's already proven that. All secondary causes of an end cause are therefore subordinate causes of that same end. Therefore, it is certain that all human beings by nature seek the first cause as their end cause. Now, right there, you might think, exactly, that's Thomas's problem. Everybody's seeking for God. That's not what he said. He just said because God has made rational creatures like that, that explains why we seek the cause of things down here. Now, Aquinas would say to the question that maybe is cropping up in your head, he would say, look, everybody is seeking for all the things that God can give, but they're not seeking it in God. They're seeking it in all the wrong places. They're seeking for permanence. They're seeking for meaning. They're seeking for love. They're seeking for all these things, for perfection. They're seeking for these things that can only be found in God, but they're seeking it outside of God. So they're misdirected in their end, but the end cause still moves and motivates people by nature. It's also very important to see that Aquinas denied that either the corporeal eye or the natural power of man can see God. That's in question 12, articles 3 and 4. He denies that. For example, he sees such texts as Psalm 35:10, in your light we see light. And in Ephesians 1:18, having the eyes of your heart enlightened. He sees this as evidence of this intellectual participation in God's essence. On the other hand, Aquinas also uses the word sight with respect to the divine essence to mean only that which we can do in that a blessed eternal state. He's talking about the beatific vision. In this lifetime, we cannot know God in a redemptive way. He agrees with that. But what we can do in this lifetime is to know God by natural reason. And there again, that will immediately provoke the debate again. There he goes. He's saying that you can know God, you can build a ladder to God by natural reason, by a grace that he's given everyone. Not quite what he said. And so I think what happens here is we pit Paul against Paul here. We pit Paul in Romans 1 against Paul in 1 Corinthians 1. What does he say in Romans 1? Everybody knows God by general revelation. What does he say in 1 Corinthians 1 and 2? No one knows God by natural means. What gives? Well, there's an equivocation going on about the meaning of the word know and knowledge. Because by general revelation, all men know by nature what condemns them about God. But here, by the Spirit, only the elect have access to that information. Aquinas completely affirms that breakdown. So there's an equivocation here. The last point I had is just this idea of there's a false dilemma between mediate and immediate revelation. And I think presuppositionalists even cite Jonathan Edwards is on their side at this point, because remember that sermon, a divine and supernatural light? Immediately? Yeah, use the word immediately. Imparted. Yeah. Immediately imparted to the soul by God. That was like the full puritanical title of the sermon. My brain isn't working at all. What did I just say? I said it right the first time. Yeah, immediate. It's immediate. A divine and supernatural light immediately imparted to the soul by God. Well, Edwards was talking about, and his text was Matthew 16, where Peter gives the confession and Jesus said, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." So what is he saying? And so Edwards goes on to unpack that idea. He's talking about salvation and the new birth and that spiritual knowledge of 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. Edwards wasn't denying that there is by nature objects of the intellect, a medium, and so on. Edwards talked at great length about the mediums of nature and how God makes himself known. All right, so that's that. I have another little syllogism on there as a mental exercise for you to see the bad thinking. But there it is. There's Thomas's theory of knowledge and language. Questions or comments?